Hello and welcome back to another episode of my podcast, Science with Milk, No Sugar. My name is Franziska and I'm your hostess. And today we have a super exciting episode, one that I've been really wanting to record for the longest time. And I finally made it happen. And my guest today is Alexandra. I first saw her, I want to say 2 years ago at a Soapbox Science event. And I've just been so inspired by her and I wanted more people to learn about her work, because Alexandra is a neuroscientist and she specializes in inhibitory interneurons and learning and memory. So she studies how memory works. But really, she has a background in molecular biology and biomedicine. She's currently a PhD candidate at Charité, which is the university hospital here in Berlin. And she's a fellow at the Einstein Center for Neurosciences here in Berlin as well. Originally, she's from Greece and has been here for a little while pursuing her research. Besides being an amazing researcher and science communicator, she also has a disability. That doesn't define her at all. She has so much to say about her work and her passion, but it is something that, of course, influences her life. And that is something we will also talk about in this episode. So we cover a lot of ground. Her work is so important and so cool. And yeah, I just wanted to ask her all the questions. And if you want to hear her answers, then do make sure to stick around. Get yourself your favorite beverage of choice. I'll be drinking an iced coffee because the weather demands it. And I'm getting right to it. So let's go.
Yeah, perfect. All right, so I'm so excited that we could make this happen. I know you're a very busy scientist and you have a lot of stuff going on. So scheduling this was just like something that I thought about for so long before I actually even reached out to you. I don't know if you know this, but I was very excited to get you on the podcast. Yeah, yeah, and lots of people recommended you, so I was like, I gotta do it now.
Oh, bless them. Thank you so much. I mean, yeah. Thank you very much for the invitation. Yeah.
Yeah, it's your work is so interesting, and I've seen you speak about your work in the past. We're going to get into that. It's just, I thought you are someone that a lot of people should hear about or hear from, you know, because what you do is super cool, in my opinion. And you're a great science communicator. I've obviously looked you up and tried to find everything I could about you, and that's why I thought you would be a great fit. And
thank you.
So I don't know if everybody is as well versed in you and has looked you up before, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about who you are and what your background is, and how did you start out as a scientist, and where did you get your degrees from?
Mm-hmm. So, hello people, or like we say in programming languages, hello world. This is the first command we type when we learn to program, right? In any kind of language, Python, MATLAB, C++, whatever. So, hello people, my name is Alexandra Tzilivaki. I am the mother of Bibi, my cat. I think that's also important as a CV, yeah. And I try to be a scientist, but apparently I think there are no scientists, there are lifelong students. So this is how I consider myself, like a lifelong student that tries to understand how the brain works. Hello from Berlin, I'm speaking to you from Berlin right now, that I am finishing my doctoral degree in medical neurosciences at the Charité Medical University here in Berlin at the lab of Professor Smith. So I'm a molecular biologist, Francesca, by training. I obtained my bachelor degree and a master degree respectively in molecular biology and biomedicine from the University of Crete in Heraklion in Greece. where I was living the last 10 years before I came here in Berlin for my PhD. And I'm also from Crete, from Greece. Yeah, I'm a bit crazy. I'm a bit Mediterranean personality, but I guess that's good. And my specialization and my research field lies in the field of computational neuroscience. So I'm trying to understand how neurons enable us to learn and to remember through the construction and the utilization of biophysical models of single neurons, of neuronal circuits, and of large networks of brain areas.
All right, cool. So is that something that you do right now? So what is your research? What do you work on right now?
Yeah, okay. So first of all, the mammalian brain, a little bit to explain some basics. The mammalian brain, you can consider it as a very, very big city. Let's say it's Berlin. And Berlin is a very multicultural city because it has citizens and residents from around the globe. So you can consider the brain like that. And the citizens of this city is the neurons, all right? The neuronal cells, that all of them are equal, but none of them is exactly the same. And if we understand the way that these neurons, these citizens of the brain city, how they communicate with each other and how they respond to each other and to sensory stimuli, then as scientists we will be able to understand how they enable us to be who we are, right? Why we remember, why we learn, why at the end of the day we exist, presumably. So there are many types of neurons, like citizens from different origins in Berlin. And one of these neuronal class, very big class, is called GABAergic interneurons, which is my favorite and the one that I study, presumably because it's the most diverse, maybe. So GABAergic interneurons are the type of neurons in the brain city that controls the excitability level of the brain and of the neuronal circuits. Disturbance of this neuronal class unfortunately leads to many neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's disease, epileptic phenomena, schizophrenia, Parkinson's disease, etc., etc. So what I try to do with computational modeling right now through my doctoral research and before and after, I guess, is that I try to understand what makes this type of neuron so special under the prism of their, if you want, subcellular molecular properties and repertoire, or under the prism of their connectivity motifs with other types of neurons. What is this that makes them so clever and intelligent to orchestrate the neuronal activity and excitability level? And what happens in cases of disease, of memory loss, for example? And then if we know what is happening, then we can prevent it. So I think that my work, which as I told you, lies in the field of computational modeling, it's the first step, because with the models, we can make predictions of how the neuron might work. And then we go to our colleagues, to our collaborators, to experimental scientists, and we say, people, look, the model says that the interneuron will perform this during a memory learning task simulation in computer if we do this or if we change this. And then they're going to test it. So my role is to make predictions, apparently, and then hopefully, if my models are right, then the experimentalists will prove it. And this is what, how we try to guide, if you want, the research field right now, to propose what is this function of interneurons that makes them so special during memory processes.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe it's a bit complicated, but yeah.
I think if you just, I liked how you said, you know, it's like a city, and you know, like you really gave us like a little mental image that's always really helpful. I think for lots of people, of course, the brain, they know it's very complex and very confusing, and what you do is at such a small scale, right? Like you cannot just easily hold it in your hand and look at it.
No, and you know, there is a paradox with the brain that we use our brain to study the brain, right? So at the point we have to overcome ourselves to understand how we work. Yeah, it's not an easy peasy task. Yeah, but this is why it's nice. Yeah.
Hi everybody, just a quick ad break to talk about today's sponsor, who's been so amazing and so supportive. And I cannot believe I'm saying this, but I'm supported by the Humboldt-Universität zu Berlin Institute for Biology, and they have a very, very cool project within the university. And I'm talking about the Collaborative Research Center 1315. They study memory and long-time memory and what happens in the brain. I mean, don't we all want to know? And they've been so, so nice. I've worked with the Equal Opportunity Officer to make this podcast possible. They've been just so great. And Humboldt Universität is just so excellent. And I feel really proud that they chose to support me in this new adventure. If you want to hear more about this research center and the SFB group, everything is going to be in the show notes and on social media. You definitely have to look them up because their website has so many amazing articles and everything about their research. And I've been on it for, I think, the last 45 minutes. So make sure to check them out. Thanks again so much for supporting this podcast. And for you guys, let's keep going.
A follow-up question to that is, you did say that, of course, maybe it's a very complex topic. When did you first discover that this is something you're passionate about? Was that before you started university? When did you know you wanted to be a scientist and wanted to do something so intense?
Yeah, from primary school, I would say. I didn't know what is a scientist. In my child brain, a scientist was a guy who has the IQ of Albert Einstein and wears, a white coat, yeah, and do magic. But I wanted to be a scientist because I wanted to find treatments about diseases. Maybe because I have one, maybe. It was a bit of altruistic, you know, child feeling, but I wanted to do it. I wanted to enter that world, and I was curious. I really enjoy to have questions and then find answers. This is why presumably I felt from a very early age that this is might be my job, although I could do other stuff. My father is an engineer, so presumably I could have, you know, continue and study engineering in my hometown, but no, I didn't. I was always a rebellious, you know, a little bit person. So yeah, and then from high school that I had the relevant subjects of biology, chemistry, mathematics, blah, 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 blah. Although I have to say I was very good also in classic subjects like language and literature and history. I like history very much. Yeah, I chose this field, this subject of natural sciences. And then the question was whether I will become a doctor, a medical doctor. My mom wanted me to be a medical doctor, of course. Or I could be a molecular biologist. And then I chose the second one because I knew that I wanted to be a researcher. So I said that it is better for me to obtain a bachelor's degree in molecular biology in order to become a researcher. And then I chose neuroscience Ah, well, I chose it. It chose me. I don't know yet. It was like this, how we say, butterflies in the stomach during the lessons. Yeah, I was impressed by the brain very much. I liked other subjects of biology, presumably, if not neuroscience, I could, I would like to study genetics, epigenetics, or molecular biology, classic molecular biology. But yeah, brain took me, yeah.
I love to ask this question because everybody has such a different answer.
Yeah.
For me, I also liked English and history. I was always good in biology, but chemistry I struggled with, and maths and physics. I always thought, oh, maybe I'll just do something with books because I love reading. And then I thought, oh, I don't know. I also really like paleontology. You know, I've always been into dinosaurs. So I ended up in science, not actually really ever wanting to be a scientist. You know, it didn't feel like my calling. I just thought the stuff that I wanted to look at is so cool, but ugh, I have to study to do this. I came with a very different approach of not wanting really to be a scientist, or not maybe, I don't know, I just always thought it's too hard for me, but then I ended up here anyway. So, yeah, very different approach.
Yeah, I mean, we never know where we, at the end of the day, we'll arrive. It's like it's a trip. You start, you follow your intuition. You have to be very honest with yourself, I think, no matter the profession, right? And this applies not only to professional life, this applies to every aspect of life, I think, personal, social, professional. You have to be honest with yourself, and honesty means that I accept my my power, I accept my will, I accept my interests, but I also accept my weaknesses, right? And then I make choices, and then I just walk, and then we see where it goes, right?
I think it's a very healthy attitude to have. I want to be more like that, you know, more honest with myself, seeing like, because I know that I'm very capable of many things, but sometimes I'm maybe a bit scared or hesitant that I cannot do something. You know, imposter syndrome, probably all have it. And some days it's stronger, and some days.
My best friend, of course. Yeah. And you know, women, they say that women most of the time suffer from imposter syndrome. I think I read this on Michelle Obama's book. She suffers from it from time to time. But I was like, okay. But then I think that the only treatment to this is exactly this, to understand who you are, your pros and your cons. Because if all of us could be perfect, then that would be very boring, I think, if we didn't have any weakness.
That's true.
Yeah, anyway. So, yeah.
So, you did, let's have a few more questions about your research, actually.
Yes, of course.
Before we go into maybe our personal life and
experiences. Philosophical
which I'm always so interested in anyway. So, yeah. We're gonna definitely get there, don't worry.
Yeah.
You talked about memory, and that's one of the things you study, how your research works and what you are looking into. And obviously, you know, you need a brain to form memories. So can you explain how your research challenges how we understand like neural activity and memory, like how your study changes like the research that's out there, or how you trying to contribute to what we know about like memory-related brain function, for example?
To answer this, now let's go back to the brain city. So now we're back to the brain city with millions and billions and trillions of citizens. And as I told you, my best friends in this brain city are the GABAergic interneurons, yeah, which is a big team of neuron people in this city, that they are responsible to control the excitability of the brain. You can consider the interneurons as the police, the policemen of the brain city. so that they control everything. What they want to understand, first of all, is that in the mammalian brain, rodent, human, monkey brain, etc., etc., interneurons are very diverse. We have classes, types, I mean, of interneuronal cells, and then it's like a tree. Every class is consistive of different subclasses. So, for example, you can classify interneurons based on some molecular features, like the expression of some particular proteins on their membranes or in general inside these neurons. For example, the parvalbumin interneurons that I study, or the somatostatin interneurons. Yeah? But this is a big class. Deep inside this class, we have others. PV subtype 1, subtype 2, subtype 3. And then my first question was, yeah, but why so many subtypes? Huh? Why we have this diversity? Why the brain city needs so many different interneuron people and not just one type to do the job? So this variability might have a meaning. So what I try to understand is why we need so many subtypes of these neurons in specific brain areas, let's say neighborhoods, that are responsible for our ability to learn and remember. For example, the hippocampus area of the mammalian brain, or the amygdala, or the prefrontal cortex, or other areas. And I try to understand how these different subtypes of interneurons in these areas perform, or if you want, they are activated or no, during different stages of memory in these areas. Because you can also classify memory. Yeah, you see, in the brain city, everything has types and subtypes and classes and subclasses, sorry. But that goes also for the memory. You can classify memory processing like encoding of a memory, which is similar to learning. I learn today, yeah, I read a book, I encode the memory, and then it's the memory retrieval process and the memory recall process, that I have already learned this and now I try to recall it on my brain. That information that I read there in this book and this book. So there are many different processes of memory. And we know from previous studies that different types of interneurons and subtypes, they are active or silent during distinct parts of memory processing. Encoding, retrieval, consolidation of the memory. So I try to understand with models why we have this. What would happen if I silence an interneuron type during encoding of a memory? Or what will happen if I activate this type during a recall of a memory? And why the brain does it like that? Why we have this organization? Why we have this orchestration? Why we need it? And this is why I use the models. So I play, my interneuron are my marionettes there. I switch on and switch off during simulations of memory procedures under distinct memory rhythms, as we say, different oscillation stages in the brain, because every part of the memory processing, whether is it a learning process or a recall memory process, has been associated with different levels of neuronal activity that we can measure with changes in the voltage, of the neurons, that we call oscillatory activity. Anyway, I don't want to go into more complex details, but I try to make associations. This is the most important, that people can remember. I try to understand why different types of interneurons are active or are silent during different stages of memory processing, from learning to recall to consolidation, And at these different stages and at these different interneuron subtypes, what are the key molecular properties of these neurons that allow them to do what they do so successfully?
A quick ad break to talk about today's sponsor. Oh my god, they have been so supportive and my biggest cheerleaders to make this podcast happen. So huge thanks to the cluster of excellence, NeuroCure. They're investigating neurological and psychiatric disease mechanisms and translating findings from basic research into clinical application. I've known about them for quite a while because they also support Soapbox Science, which is one of my biggest passions. I've been a member since 2019, and I thank them so much for sponsoring this podcast. They've been nothing but supportive and kind, and if you haven't heard of NeuroCure, you absolutely have to look them up. My links are in the show notes. If you want to learn more about them, you won't regret it. And yeah, let's get back to the episode.
And you said that you didn't want to be a medical doctor, but do you see potential for any kind of applications of your research in the future, maybe in patients? Is that something that is already happening or that might happen in the future?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that this is the idea. I'm doing basic research. How can you find a treatment? How can you design a drug for something if you don't know the control state, which is the healthy state? We don't even know today exactly how it works, how it goes during healthy conditions. So this is where we stand. This is where models, computational models of brain cells are useful, because we predict how it works and we predict how it will not work if we change this and this and this and this and that. So we need this kind of basic research information, because this is the very first and most important step towards a treatment approach. We have to know the control, so then we check what it is wrong during disease. We have to compare between control and disease, and then we try to apply treatment and see how we can go back to the healthy phenotype, right? So my work is to prove or to predict how it works, and then we compare with the disease model to understand how we can secure the phenotype.
That's awesome. I love to hear from people trying to actually, with their research, really improve people's lives.
Yeah.
I think it just gives me so much joy to hear that people are working on these things. So I sometimes get really, like my best friend's grandfather had Alzheimer's, and it was really difficult for the family. And obviously that's also something where you lose access to your memories, or you lose memories altogether, or only remember certain types of memories, right? But that there's people out there that are trying to help patients or do research that will in the future help patients. I think that is just so important and so awesome. I don't know if you sometimes just go to work and you think that.
Apparently it's a good motivation to think like that. Although science, it's a team game. You cannot understand the brain alone, or you cannot find the cure for Alzheimer's disease alone. This is impossible, and it's nice that it is impossible. So I don't think I'm gonna save someone. I wish I could, really, I wish I could. But maybe all of my effort maybe one day will help another colleague of mine to think further, and then the other colleague, and then the next generation. So, you know, year by year, brain by brain, every one of us at least tries, and that's the most important. This is why I consider that for a scientist, It is a kind, if you want, Francisca, of an ethical duty to communicate his or her work, right? It's not to, we don't do it to receive the applause, or for the prestige, or for the, oh, thank you so much. No, why? No, there is nothing to thank. But I consider that it is, at least for me, I'm going to talk personally, it is my ethical duty, because science is done from people and for the people, for the community. And this is why it's our ethical duty, duty to inform the community about where we stand, to inform the community about what it is going on, what we are trying to do, where is the field going, to keep them updated, because apparently that's our aim.
100%. I don't even think I have anything to add. That's something I always say when people ask me why science communication is important. Like, that is 100% why you need to inform the public. Plus, a lot of the funding comes from the public.
Exactly.
So really just telling them how the money's
used. Yeah.
If you want to be very pragmatic about it. So we already talked a little bit about people and, you know, because communicating it hopefully is reaching people. In your opinion, what are some misconceptions maybe people have about scientists, and how do you think you can break down these stereotypes with the kind of science communication that you do?
First of all, that we are very rich, which is not true, to be honest. Yeah, they think that, some people think that we have the ideal life, the ideal profession, but come and tell me now what it is ideal and perfect in this planet. Nothing. There are always two sides of a coin. There is always the yin and the yang. And I think that at the end of the day, what matters is how you think about stuff and what you decide that this is going to be my attitude, this is going to be how I will move into this system. But the first misconception is that we are ideal, that everything is perfect. No, it's not. I want to be honest. I don't want to make everything like gold. It's not. Yeah. It's a kind of insecure and stressful job. Although I don't like to use the word job for science, because it's a lifestyle. It's not a job. It's not a 9-to-5 thing, Monday to Friday. It's a lifestyle. It defines you. And you have to sacrifice a lot from social life from time to time, from personal life from time to time. You have to move abroad. You have to maintain the concept of excellence and competitive CV through the years, from the very early stage of your career until the seniority of professorships. It's not an easy peasy. It's like a marathon. You start and you never stop. So that's a misconception, because people, they think that we are fine, we have fun, and that, Another misconception that I'm very sad about it, and I try whenever I have the opportunity to highlight it, is that you don't need to be Albert Einstein if you want to become a scientist, right? We are not anything exceptional. I'm not something extremely special, you know what I mean? I just, as I told you, as I introduced myself, I am a lifelong student. That's me. And if I knew anything, then why do I do research? If I know everything, why I make a hypothesis and I have questions if I had all the answers? You know, that's a bit of contradiction. So sometimes when I visit schools, when I give talks to students, etc., they have a kind of attitude that, you are very clever. You are intelligent. I'm not more than you. I'm a normal person.
Yeah, I experienced that a lot. That.
Yeah, and being successful in science, and that's a take-home message from our today's podcast. Being successful in science requires passion, requires discipline, yeah, requires long-term effort to try to be every day a little bit better, not from the others, but from your yesterday self. Because apparently this is also the idea of excellence, right? The continuous improvement, the continuous learning. So this is the scientist. We are not genius, all of us. Okay, yeah, we are clever, okay, if we are capable to have the IQ to obtain a PhD or a bachelor or a master degree, then of course we can do it, and it's for everyone. And if someone wants to be, he can be, and that's my message. Because still we have this bias that we are a kind of elite. No, we are not.
Yeah, I had this conversation many a times with my parents when I tried to tell them, like there was in the beginning of my career when I tried to tell them the kind of research I do. And sometimes it'd be like, oh, but we don't understand, like we're not like you, it's really hard for us. And I said, you know, it took me, first of all, a lot of years to get here. And then also, it's also not just easy for me. Like I also have to, you know, spend hours and hours researching this and doing my own experiments and my own like data collection. And my dad learned how to, you know, repairs cars. He used to be a mechanic. And there is no way that I could just be put in front of a car and repair it. I would have no idea how to do that. And he, you know, he also learned how to do that and was passionate about it and had to study how to do these things. And once I like tried to, you know, bring us on the same level and said, you know, it's not just, I wasn't born like this. You knew how I struggled in school sometimes, you, my parents. It's just the passion that I had and the persistence and wanting to understand. And I think that just applies to so many professions, but yet somehow scientists are often seen as, well, you were just born smart and now you're a scientist, which is not always the case. Maybe it's for some people, but yeah, I think this is just something that lots of people just expect. They kind of, we just want to tell them that we're the same, you know, we're nothing special. But sometimes we get, against our consent, kind of like othered. You are more smart and therefore this is what you do, and I'm not as smart, so I don't, which is not true at all. Yeah, it's and my own parents have done that to me. They understand now and they have just, we talked a lot about what I do, and they see my side now. Yeah, and I hope I can communicate that when I give talks, that I also don't know everything sometimes. When it's about like I give a talk about paleontology or something like that, that doesn't mean that I understand every single thing about every fossil that has ever been found.
Exactly.
But somehow I'm supposed to, just because I'm a paleontologist, I'm supposed to know all of it. And I sometimes try to teach people that scientists do not know everything, right? Like, I think the more you're actually in the academic ladder, the more you know that you don't know.
Exactly. Exactly. And I remember back in my bachelor studies, a professor told us once the answer, quote, I don't know, is a scientific answer. Because it's true. In most of the cases, we don't know. And this is why we exist as scientists. Because if we knew how the brain works, for example, in my case, or if you could have any answer in your own field, Francisca, then okay, the society, they doesn't need us. They don't need us anymore, you know? So we go to retire. There are open questions, so this is why scientists exist.
We talked a little bit about your passion, and I think it comes through and when you told me what your work is about. And you have won several awards, prestigious awards, and that's amazing. I think well deserved. Do you feel that these acknowledgement have influenced your career in a big way, and maybe especially considering added challenges with being a scientist with a disability, do you think this has really helped you? Or what is your take on that?
First of all, I'm very happy and glad that I see that my effort, I will not say success, I will say effort, because I'm not the one that will say if I do something good or no. I can say that I try, and the others will answer. But all these awards for me, I'm happy.
You're very modest, by the way. Okay. You're so modest.
No. The brain is the king. All the others, we are just servants here. Yeah, but it makes me happy, because I feel that people recognize not my achievements, but the importance of the research that I participate. Yeah, that's it, I think. That funders, institutions, organizations, awards, prizes, all of these, it's a message that, maybe what you do makes sense. Maybe you should continue. Yeah, okay. And that's the emotional part, the motivational part, the personal part. Now we have always a practical part of everything. As I said, it's not an ideal profession, because there is no ideal profession. In order to survive in academia, and I use the word survive because it describes the situation very well, you have to be very competitive, Francesca. Apparently, you have to be perfect, or try for the perfection. And for us, as people with a career, kind of, an academic career, we need a competitive CV. That's important. Especially for the young scientists like me. We need a lot of publications. We need to show that our research has an impact on the society. We have to prove our excellence. And to do that, we need the publications, as I said before, our actual work, and the recognition of this work, which is the award. So the more competitive a CV is, the more the awards, the more the scholarships, the more the fellowships, the prizes, and blah, 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 everything like that, the more possible is for me to continue, because it's more possible that the university, a rector, a professor will trust me and tell me, come with me, I believe you, your hypothesis makes sense, you seem capable to do it, you seem excellent to do it, go and do it. Do you want the money to do it? Take the money. So we need it as a proof that someone can rely on me, on us, on the team, on the scientific team, and can trust me or the team that we will give answers about the brain. So every prize, every part in the CV that makes it fabulous, kind of, and prestigious, apparently it helps me to continue. And yes, related to the disability, I want to tell you something weird here. When I was younger, I was trying to hide the fact that I use a wheelchair everywhere, from any kind of application, because I wanted to see whether they will give me the prize, the biases. I wanted to see if they will give me the prize purely based on my CV. And when I took this recognition and I say, I can stand alone, then now I don't care, I don't hide it, I don't highlight it. I have blonde hair and I have a disability. If they care, fine. If they don't care, fine as well. The award, it had helped me through my life, not specifically because of the disability, in general for my life, because they enabled me to continue. And for example, if I didn't have these awards, then it wouldn't be so easy for me to convince here my current employer, that take me, I'm good in my work, use me in a good way, I will do what you want, I'm clever, you see, I have an award. That's it. So it helps you to continue, to continue, to continue, to maintain a career, to create a career, to become later on independent in academia for someone that wants to build a labor, yeah, a lab and become a professor. It's important for the career in general, I would say. So it is for me.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think listeners are also going to be able to understand why awards make sense and, yeah, and that they're just helpful. And yeah. Also elevating you and your research. So makes it more visible, right? There are always announcements about awards and things like that, at least in the community of scientists. So, yeah, makes 100% sense that you see it like that. Are there any specific challenges that you've faced as a scientist with a disability? Have you had special ways to deal with them? Or has everything been like smooth sailing?
Oh, yeah. God, no.
Yeah, maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. Like barriers and how you overcome them.
Yeah, challenge is my second name. What do you mean? First of all, I'm a woman with whatever that it means. I am coming from not very financially flourishing country, to be honest, especially during the years that I was obtaining my bachelor degree. I am disabled, I use a wheelchair. So you can consider me as the minority of the minority. And because we were talking about prizes and grants, sometimes they ask you to check whether you are eligible about anything related to diversity. I am all. I'm straight in my sexual orientation, but all the others I'm diverse and minority of the minority. Yeah, fair enough. So, yes, it is an obstacle. It is. And basically, it is an obstacle related to mobility. Because I told you before, I will explain to you what I mean mobility in science. I told you before that we need, in order to survive in academia and to flourish in our career, we need a competitive CV. And I told you before that a competitive CV means scientific publications and means prizes and awards. A competitive CV means also mobility. And that is that a scientist, throughout the years, started somewhere his research as a mentee, as a student, okay, worked in a lab in one country with a professor, with a boss, and then moved to another country and did something else and had another specialization. And this is an indicative example in a CV of an independence of the scientist, that I can work independently, I can collaborate with other scientists from different countries, with different perspectives, even on the same scientific questions. So it shows to a reviewer that, this lady can do this and this and that, this person, no matter the gender. So for me, with a wheelchair, how easy is to move around the globe? Not that easy. It's not that easy for me, especially when I was a student back in Greece, to go kind of summer schools, you know, that we have, that students, bachelor, master, or doctoral students, or even postdocs, attend schools, and about a particular field, summer schools, for 1 month, for 2 months. For me, it was impossible to go, because imagine that someone needs to cover the expenses to go to the schools that are quite expensive, only the registration. And for me, I had to be accompanied by personal assistants. Who is going to pay for them? Me? With a very small kind of stipend that you can barely live with it in Greece nowadays? No. So some stuff for me that could presumably could help my CV to be even more competitive, that was not even an option for me. So for me, in order to maintain my competitive CV and be productive, I had to overcome it all the time. And living with a disability is not easy, it's not an everyday task. I guess you can imagine at some extent what does it mean. So on top of that, to want to be an excellent scientist, to fight all these obstacles is definitely not easy, and there are not that many, unfortunately, there are not that many examples for me to follow. I mean, I am used to it that I am the only one in conferences, in labs, in whole departments of universities. I mean, everyone recognizes me. I'm the only one. And that's sad. I laugh, but it's sad. So I always have to invent the wheel to move abroad, to convince the funders that my research grant should be higher because my needs are different.
I feel like, or I don't know if you see it like that, you said you're often the only one, or you're always the only one. Are your hopes that you maybe really making it easier for academics with disabilities in the future? I mean, do you feel that you know, breaking the ceiling is going to help people in the future? And actually, the question I want to lead onto is, sometimes, you know, when I do advocacy work, it comes with responsibility, right? The representation and the emotional labor, and educating others about barriers for students with disability or researchers with disabilities. Have there been times where you just tired, where, you know, where sometimes you don't want to always be the one educating others on this? Or do you thrive? Do you feel like, this is great, I can make it easier for students in the future? You know what I mean? Because sometimes I'm really passionate about like soapbox science, for example, but sometimes I just wish things would be different and I didn't have to do all this emotional labor. How do you feel about this?
Yeah. Okay. To answer the first part, as a person, I am very optimistic as a personality, but I'm also very rational. Maybe I will disappoint you, but it's gonna take much time to see equality and equity, a normal, if you want, participation of people with physical dysfunction in science, or with people from a kind of underrepresented background. It will take time, and this is, first of all, because of the lack of role models right now. Yeah, there are not many, because apparently this is our human nature. If we see others, then we want to try, you know? It's an instinct, like babies. Oh, they see their mom and dad doing this and this and that, and then they want to do the same. But if a young student, let's say now, yeah, even in a strong and great country like Germany, with the top social benefit people, huh? Let's take this example, not other countries. But even here, let's say there is a student who has a charisma in a kind of a scientific field, no matter what, and wants to obtain a career, but has a physical dysfunction or another kind of an obstacle, because some are visible and some are not. How many examples do you see in the field that the guy then can say, okay, that person did it, then I'm gonna do this and this and that, and I'm gonna fulfill my dreams like that? No, there are not many. And especially for science, that it is a very, very demanding lifestyle profession, that even if you walk, even if you don't walk, whatever, you have to sacrifice, as I told you, a lot. Then how much power do you need also to overcome these difficulties? When I wanted to move from Greece to Germany for the PhD, I was the only one, because I'm here without a family. I'm alone with my cat. And we didn't know how this will go, because under the European Commission umbrella, there is current no regulation about the rights of disabled employees, scientists or dancers or whatever it is, the profession, that they move around Europe. You know, there is nothing about the social benefits from country to country, about the care system. There was nothing, so we had to invent the wheel, and it took me 4 years. Don't ask me why I didn't give up. Now, I don't know, maybe because I'm very stubborn, and maybe because I have a great advisor. My professor helped a lot. But apart from that, it was a utopia. It was, the chances were 0.5% of success. So then how can you say to someone, how can I go to a public talk and say, yeah, you can be a scientist, even if you have this and this and that. I would say that nothing in this life is impossible, of course, but honestly, we are not there yet. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. And it is a kind of a political issue, I would say, and a kind of European level political issue, that there is no regulation, there is no law about mobility in Europe and work abroad if you have a physical disability or if you have another thing. No, so this is the first step. So first we have to settle that. And then I think that all the others will come. And now, I don't think to go to your second, to the second part of your question, I don't feel that I am a role model. So I don't have this weight on my shoulders when I talk. Of course, I understand that I can raise awareness if I talk about my own challenges and my own experiences. And if I ever something good happens from this, I will be extremely satisfied. But as I said, I am a lifelong student and I try to be a scientist. That's me. I don't feel that weight again on my shoulders. I hope I will try, and I hope that given that even after years of trial and error, for me, by moving from Greece to Germany, I did it. At least, maybe I am a sign of a happy end, kind of. That says it happened to me, it can happen to you, it can happen to everyone. And I hope. But still, for me, that now, after a lot of trial and error, I am in a much better position. Obstacles are always appearing, right? Coming and going. So it's a continuous effort for everyone. And last but not least, let me highlight this once again. My obstacle is visible. You will remember me. I told you I'm the only one in the department. But every person has something in this life. Some obstacles are visible, some obstacles are not visible. So it's not nice to compare. Everyone tries, everyone has a bright and a dark side, but mm-hmm. at the end of the day, yeah, it's all about trial and error. So everyone can be a role model. If he's honest enough to say out loud what he tries to do, what is his dream, and what he's experiencing along the way.
Yeah, I think you said that so well. I think maybe if someone doesn't want to be a role model, they can still be an inspiration to others. And I think, I mean, you're an inspiration to me. I know we chose you for Soapbox Science because other people on the team were inspired by your work. Yeah, it's just great to see what you do, and that is like solely focused on the work that you do. Like I said earlier, I'm really impressed by your work, and I'm so glad that people are studying this stuff. I think if someone sees you as a role model, there's nothing you can do about that. If someone is like, wow, that's my role model, I want to be like that, then I think you maybe have to just accept it. You cannot choose it sometimes.
Oh, gosh.
To be an inspiration to others, I think is a lovely thing. And I think you inspire a lot of people.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, thank you. At the end of the day, this is what matters, right? To, mm-hmm. I mean that's my biggest dream, I think, in life, to be able to do something good for someone else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems a little bit altruistic, but I think that if you live a life only focusing on you, you will end up miserable.
Yeah.
The more you give, the more you get. That's the energy.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We talked about, some maybe not so ideal things and what needs to change and what, and some good things, of course. But what would you say is the most rewarding, maybe not in a specific moment, but what is most rewarding as you work as a scientist and as a communicator? Is there something that you really love besides the fact that, you know, you want to contribute to the research? is there something you enjoy the most in your work?
Mm-hmm. That particular feeling of discovery, that particular feeling after days, weeks, months, years that you try to test a hypothesis, scientific hypothesis, you are into this kind of puzzle that you try to collect and connect the pieces of the parts of the answers that you have found in order to understand the story behind, let's say, the scientific questions in the neurons and memory states, like I told you before. That moment that you will say, oh yeah, now it makes sense. Oh yeah, this is it. Mm-hmm. That was it. That was the mechanism. That, oh God, that's blow-minding. I cannot describe this, yeah? It is so much satisfactory that even if you spend years of failure, you know, kind of, that you cannot find the answer to your scientific questions, that moment, it's like a drug. I don't know how to describe it. It's a boost of energy. It's like, oh God, I found it. That was it. It doesn't last long, but it's a life experience. Well, when we have it. So that's one thing. So we live for the moment in this profession, I'm telling you. We suffer from that moment of discovery. Anyway, and the other is, we are weird people. So, and the other is, I like it when I can transfer knowledge to younger people, to younger students. When I, for example, supervise someone and he comes to me without prior knowledge on the field, I feel this responsibility that now I'm gonna train you, I'm gonna teach you, I'm gonna help you to become a better one from what you were yesterday, scientifically, but also personally. So that if I hear that someone that I supervised in a project won a prize, for example, or a scholarship, oh, that's a huge satisfaction for me. I don't know why. I like it very much. When I'm able to transfer knowledge and to see other people's theories, it's not that I take the credits, you know. It's the success and the failure is on that person. My success, my failure, your success, your failure. But still, I feel happy. So I like it very much. And another thing that I like in this, how I call it, lifestyle profession, is something that many colleagues hate. It's the publishing, the defend mode that you have when you submit a scientific article with your results and your job, and then you have, it's like a chess game then, and then you have to defend your results and your work to the reviewer too, like we say in some kind of social media, Twitter,
famous reviewer too.
What is this quote? The memes. The reviewer too. I'm gonna find you one day that you killed my paper and you rejected my result. No, I like it. I like it because I like to present my arguments. Of course, I accept the criticism if it is with a good heart. And I like to defend, to stand in front and say, okay, now I'm here, I'm gonna do the job, I'm gonna defend it. I like that, although it's stressful, but it's a kind of battle, it's a kind of chess game, and I like it. Anyway, things that I don't like, there is something I hate, the insecurity. Believe it or not, the financial insecurity, it's something that kills my motivation because I'm a human being. If I was every day 24/7 happy and motivational and optimistic, then okay, that's not normal. That's a disorder as well. But this insecurity, you know, we don't have tenure. It's very difficult in academia. The ultimate goal in academia, mine and of everyone that stays in academia, is a tenure, to know that this is your job. You're gonna retire from that institute. Because then, if you know that from now on you will belong in this institute, you have all the time, if you're alive, to do your science and to test scientific hypotheses. But if your contract is 1 year contract or 2 years contract, not because you are not good enough, but because this is the system in this lifestyle profession, and this is insecure, at least for me. At least for me. I am a person that I like to take risks, you know? I am a person that I am overambitious. I don't like this kind of routine. I like to try new things. But I need to feel that the wheels of my wheelchair, if you want, are in a stable ground. You know?
Yeah.
So this type of insecurity that we have, PhDs, the postdocs, especially the postdocs, it's unbelievable. And it concerns me because this doesn't allow us to do exactly what we want sometimes. We have to follow the trends. I'm very honest. Yeah? I will never lie. We have to follow from time to time the trends. And say, okay, now the European Commission gives some money for that kind of disorder research. Now they want to understand Parkinson and not Alzheimer, let's say, an indicative example. So I have to put a little bit my research and the discussion of my paper into this direction, a little bit. Since we money are involved, I will be honest, we have to make the square, to make the angles, to change the angles in the square a little bit. You know, it's part of the game. So this, I don't like it. I cannot change it, of course. And then it's my choice whether I stay or should I stay or should I go. You know, this one, I choose to stay because what I like is much more of what I don't like. I don't give up on something because I don't like everything. Because no matter what I do in my life, there is always a not that bright side, right? So I choose to stay and I choose to fight against and I choose to defend myself and my career and my CV and my security in academia as much as possible.
Yeah, you already answered my very last question about do you want to stay in research? I think it sounded very much like you do want to do that. But do you have any specific plans? What comes next? And do you think your future will be in Germany or do you think you'll move again, if possible?
I like here. I like Berlin. Berlin brain city, what we learned today. I'm happy to stay here. A lesson that I learned towards my journey from Greece to Berlin and all the bureaucracies, the bureaucratic obstacles, and the mobility and the disability obstacles, I have learned not to make big statements, because we don't know. Life is sometimes unpredictable. What I can tell you is that I want to finish my PhD, and I want to be a scientist. I want to be an academic scientist. You called me modest before, and thank you, but I believe that I'm quite ambitious. So I would like to continue in academia if I deserve it. I'm not the one that will say that. Others will tell me. Yeah, I would be happy if this is in Berlin. I would be very happy if I had a life here in Berlin. Yeah. But,
right. Yeah. Then I hope that we can keep you here.
Keep me here.
Ambitious student. Ambitious PhD students. Keep me. And I always love to see women in science, you know, staying in academia and just absolutely killing it, you know, and doing cool research. And so I very much hope that they will keep you. Yeah, I want to thank you so much for sharing your perspective and your work with me. People were listening. And
thank you.
Yeah, it was super fun to talk to you. I hope to follow all of your science communication in the future. I will put your details in the description so people can find you and find the podcast. So thank you so much for taking your time to talking to us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. I also want to thank you again for listening. And a special shout out goes to the Equal Opportunity Offices of NeuroCure and SFB. I will put everything you need to know about them in the show notes, so you'll find everything you need to know and everything you could ever be interested in about them. And also make sure to give us a rating wherever you're listening to podcasts and follow our social media. Once again, everything is linked. You'll find us on the internet. Don't you worry, we're very visible. And I'm very excited about the next episode. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss another episode again. Thank you and goodbye.